Now, one thing that Scott and I agreed on, which he has that example on the book, and that's probably why we began talking to each other a lot way back in the mid-80s, is the following, right? Every time somebody talks to you about where the mind came from, they keep on talking about how difficult it must have been to evolve the human mind, right? Out of inanimate matter, you end up with the human mind with all its complexity, its power, and its subtlety, and things of that sort, right? And every now and then, you get creationists come along and say, it's impossible that the human mind could have evolved out of purely ordinary biological, right, material forces. My mind could not have come about that way. There isn't enough time. So let's look at that problem in two separate ways. First, there isn't enough time. What could that conceivably mean to you, right? So step back for a second. All of you are about 20 years old, I assume, right? Most of you are about that. If you are older, I know a couple of you are younger. So you probably have a fairly good idea of what 20 years means, right? And probably a fairly good idea of what 40 years means. Your parents might be more or less around that age, a bit younger, possibly a bit older, and things of that sort, right? You probably can go all the way up to 100, and by the time you're talking about your grandparents or your great-grandparents and all of that, would be 100 years old, right? Sit back for a minute and ask, what does it mean for 200 years? Think of what the world was like 200 years ago. Okay? I'm asking you to go back to 1819. Do you know when that is? That's just after the Napoleonic era. That's how far back I've gone by the time I've gone to 1819. Nobody had dreamt of things like electricity and stuff like that. There wasn't even speculation about that. Okay? There had been speculation about flying machines way back in the 1500s by Leonardo da Vinci and people like that, but nobody had thought there would be such a thing as electricity back then, let alone cars or anything of that sort. The maximum distance an average person traveled in his or her life, if you're in a country like England, is about 10 to 20 miles away from where you were born. Everybody with me? Okay. Now think back about 1,000 years. You're in the Middle Ages, right? The great civilizations of the world at that point are based out of Damascus and Baghdad. That are the centers of learning. These are the places where things that were lost everywhere else, like the great works of Greek philosophy, were being kept by the Arabs in manuscript form in both Greek and Arabic, okay? In a period where the first universities of the so-called West are starting out in Paris. Nobody had yet heard of Plato or Aristotle, completely forgotten. Around that time, a few people in France managed to make the difficult trek out to the Arab world and bring back Plato to the West. Everybody with me? They're incredibly powerful civilizations in China and India, nothing in the West at all compared to that, okay? Richest countries in the world are India and China by a far, far margin, and then it's the Arab world, the caliphates, based around contemporary Iraq, contemporary Syria. Go back 2,000 years, okay? That you're going back to the period when the great Greek civilizations are sort of in decline. Again, the great civilizations of the world are going to be in China and India, which are up there, over there. Another 2,000 years, you end up in a period where you are talking about mainly Babylon and places like that, five different centers in the world where there are important civilizations that happen to be. The oldest one is in Mesopotamia. Then you have slightly younger one in Egypt. Contemporary with that is the Chinese, and a slightly younger one in India, that's what you have, and some other. There's a fifth segment also in the Middle East, not clearly separated from Mesopotamia. That's what you have. 2,000 years before that, you probably are in a situation when there's no writing. Okay. By the time you get back to 10,000 years, agriculture barely exists. Are you getting the idea of how long these times are? And then somebody comes and tells you the mind evolved over about 800 million years. You have any idea what 800 million years means? Any psychological sense of that? Okay. What can be done in 800 million years? And from that point of view, and this is what sometimes biologists nowadays, in analogy to deep space, call deep time. We are talking about deep time. And to assert that something is evolutionarily impossible or impossible because time is not enough, when you're talking about billions, sometimes 4 billion years, is just plain absurd. It's just appealing to psychologically. And I am emphasizing the same kind of theme, right? That Scott and Clara have been emphasizing in this book, is that the words are hiding behind them. They're using the words are appealing to hidden prejudices and stuff like that. You have that, oh, it must be very short time because somebody told you that it was a short time, too short a time for mind to have evolved. You have no clue what can be, I have no clue what can or cannot be done evolutionarily over 800 million years. And so you shouldn't either say there obviously was enough time or there was not enough time. Unless you sit down and do real calculations about rates of evolution, what you can know from the fossil record and all of that, you should make absolutely no claim about what can or cannot be done over times like that. That's what the proper attitude is. It's beyond our psychological understanding. We need mathematics to understand that. And the kind of understanding that comes from mathematical calculations is not something that coheres very easily with whatever we understand psychologically. Everybody with me? There might be no miracle. I certainly think there's no hint of a miracle in mind having evolved from matter that way. I'm not saying it did, but I just don't think that there's anything in it that suggests that a miracle of any kind is required, right? Good, everybody with me? All right. Now consider the following kind of experience, one that I went through myself. I saw an image of my daughter when she was less than 100 cells, okay? I was very interested in this stuff, so after my wife was pregnant, I had images taken, and I have a whole sequence of these images over a period of time. Those of you who are not children of biologists are probably very lucky. Nobody intruded in your privacy in that way in the early period of being a few cells. Okay, this chunk of cells, in no remote sense, could be considered to have anything like a mind or anything of this sort. Shortly afterwards, a few of those cells began to vibrate a bit. We call it a heartbeat. There's nothing really that is heartbeat about it. In fact, if you ever see one of those scopes that's put on a pregnant woman's stomach to make it all, the heartbeat only comes because those motions get amplified using sound. That's where it all comes from. There is no beat there. It really is a particular motion. And the chances are somewhere close to it, a lot of organs, including hearts, will eventually form. Calling that a heartbeat is pure mythology. I wish Scott had included that example, but I was surprised to find he hadn't, okay? And now, about 9 months later, right? Okay, this mass of cells started out as one cell, bunch of DNA in it, a lot of proteins, a few lipids and all of that, emerges and it has something like a mind, right? Moment after birth. All in 10 months. Mind is not fully formed. She was probably dumber than Donald Trump right when she was born. took another few months before sort of you reach the same mental level. Okay. Another few months before you reach the same emotional level and stopped having tantrums. But all of this stuff happens in about, after the crucial thing is 10 months and then another 10 months or so. Now that, all of it happens in 10 months. Mind emerges, or if you like, 20 months. Mind emerges from our matter. If anything, that strikes me as being a miracle. Everybody with me? And that's the example that Scott starts out the book with, right? If you're looking for a miracle, look at development, human development. How did that happen, right? It's one of the great, to some extent, unsolved problems of the world. If somewhere you're looking for something that looks miraculous, that's where you should be looking, right? How miraculous is it? All right, about 25 years ago, I had to have some work done on one of my teeth, and I had a relatively bad dentist, right, who completely cut up this part of my mouth, sort of stitched it up and all of it, okay? And I was wondering whether I would have a very interesting looking set of lips afterwards because it was all cut up and all of it. And when the cells got together, was not a particularly pleasant experience. I would not suggest that you do it as an excuse. Eventually, the lips formed exactly as they were before. The form regained itself. Everybody with me? For all the contingencies and all of that involved, somehow the shape of life remained the same. How puzzling is the shape of life? About 7 or 8 of you have been in classes of mine before will know this example and are probably tired of it, but you'll hear it again. If you take all the animals with all the diversity around the world and you look at them at the stage when they're just getting from the embryo to the fetus, okay, or the corresponding one in invertebrates, you don't exactly distinguish things that way, right? All of them will have either fivefold symmetry, like starfish, or twofold symmetry, like us. You never get nothing else. Okay? You don't even get the Holy Trinity. Just 2 or 5. Why? Obviously, rules govern it, right? Can't be a matter of accident. These are rules we actually don't know. All right? Development is one of the most poorly understood parts of biology, right? Okay. And Scott is going to take you through, as you read this book, as much of it as we know and as well as you can. He's one of the authors of one of the 2 standard textbooks of development used in American universities, including our own, and where we are with respect to that. And the crucial part of development that he's going to worry about for the first half of the book, which is what is being assigned now, and we'll get back to the latter half of the book much later on in the course after we've dealt a bit with problems of gene editing and things of that sort, right? What you're dealing with is the situation in which you go from being individual gametic cells, sperm cells, and egg cells, right? All the way you go up to actually being born, right? And why is this so crucial for people to understand what happens and what can? One obvious answer, of course, is that this is where what you can and should or should not do over here is what is behind one of the most politically controversial issues in our society today in the U.S., not in quite a lot of the else of the world where it's taken to be much more obvious, that is the issue of abortion, right? Okay? And one of the things we are going to do in class is to see what, if anything, science can say about that. And what you'll find at the end of it, to get to the punchline, is the really troublesome questions there, if you find them troublesome, are not questions of science. Science cannot answer that question, or as Scott and Carla put it, Scott put it earlier in another book of his, whenever there's an appeal to science in all of this, right, scientists are being asked theological questions, and it's not our business to try to answer those, okay? And that's a very, very important point that one should hold across the board, okay? For instance, some of my colleagues teach evolution here, and when they're teaching the evolution class, given, of course, it's died out recently, but the long history of attempts to get creationism into the curriculum, the science curriculum in Texas schools, some of them come out and try to prevent that kind of a dispute by coming out and say that evolution is completely compatible with Christianity. And my response to these scientists is, don't say that in a science class. Okay. Don't say it's not compatible. Don't say it's a compatible. You say it's not a scientific question. It should not enter into a science class. Everybody with me? Okay? And similarly, in this class, I'm actually not going to take any position whatsoever about the actual morality or non-morality, right, of abortion and all of that. I will just point, we will stick to what science says, and then you'll get is a bunch of if this, then that kind of results. Everybody with me? Okay. I could, without violating anything, probably go a bit further in a class like this, because this is at the fundamental level of philosophy class, right? And so I am allowed to go beyond where science goes, but it's also cross-listed as a biology class now, and because of that, I'm not going to go that extra thing beyond, and I quite frankly wouldn't want to do so unless there was enough time to look at the issues of policy and ethics that are that would have to be treated in detail. In particular, the crucial issue that needs over there is at what point does somebody else have any right to tell you what you choose to do with your own body? Okay? I mean, to me, that's the deepest question there. It's not the doctor-patient confidentiality on which Roe versus Wade rests. It's a pure issue of privacy. I don't like the idea of anybody intruding on my personal autonomy, and I'm only willing to tolerate that if the situation absolutely demands it, and it's clear-cut that there is such a demand. And later on in this class, we'll come across this over and over again in the context of eugenics, right? Planning the genetic future. Can anybody tell you what to do or not? And the answer is going to be the same. It's going to be a question of what you think about personal autonomy. And of course, it'll play itself out in an even more interesting way when the issue will come up, which we'll discuss in detail in this class, is should there be mandatory vaccination? Everybody with me? Okay, so anyway, that's where we're going to end up. The other part, of course, of what makes this issue particularly socially important, is the one that's even less discussed, or even abortion is discussed quite enough. Usually the trouble is that nobody has bothers to listen to anything the other side says. They've made up their minds when early childhood, as far as I can tell, and they're going to believe that no matter what. The issue that nobody discusses is the question of reproduction, fertility, infertility, and what the benefits and costs are of intervening in these. Everybody with me? And I'll say a fair amount of that because that was one of your readings, one of the chapters you read today, right? The infertility and its consequences. Yeah. Okay. So I will discuss that today. Okay. So any questions so far? Anything I've said that's already shocking? Most of the things I say about this it tend to shock somebody or the other, but so far I've been trying to stay on completely neutral ground to the extent I can. Mm-hmm. Especially about Donald Trump, as you heard. So the first thing to watch out, and this is something I probably should have done even at the beginning of class, but I didn't partly because I wanted you to enjoy reading Scott and Clara, is a reminder that there can be a great gap between what science says and how it is described. Okay? They give examples of that in the context of how people talk about fertilization and stuff of this sort, right? The example, if I had done this discussion at the beginning of class, would have pointed out is how glibly people keep on talking about X is genetic or Y is genetic and all of that, and that it's often calling something genetic is completely meaningless. Everybody with me? Because in one sense, every single trait in you is genetic. If you did not have the genes you have, right, you wouldn't be here to be able to show. You wouldn't be here to have to show that particular trait. In another sense, if I took all your genes, right, took a cell from your body and locked it up on a test tube and put it away, it will not become another you. Genes are clearly not enough. In that sense, depending on what you mean by is genetic, nothing happens to be genetic. And if it's a question of how things interact and how the interplay of different causes ends up producing the thing that you are, you can't quantify the different effects. And you really need to be sensitive to how much of this is very, very contingent on historical accidents, what might have happened in utero or afterwards in terms of particular ways in which the environment could have impeded or influenced what happens in the genetic level. Everybody with me? Any questions? All right. Now, where the good place to start here, right, is going to be, what do we know? So I'll do it in two things. I'll say a bunch of things that were already said in the chapter about fertilization. What exactly do we know about it? And then we'll worry about fertility and its difficulties and things of the sort, and what exactly is being circumvented, how subtle the process is, and then we can spend some time worrying about why does it seem to matter so much to people for them to be able to say that they are genetically related to their offspring. And along with Clara, I'll also point out some of the oddness of social attitudes towards that and where they come from, okay? All right, what do you know about fertilization? Okay, let's stick to the assumption that all of you are either male or female reproductively. Everybody with me? Okay. You might choose not to reproduce. I'm not questioning that whatsoever. And I'm certainly not questioning the existence of other genders and all of that. I'm just trying to take the simplest case here and see how complicated it's going to be. In the case of females, every proto-egg that can develop into an egg in you was already there at the time of birth. Okay? Everybody with me? People don't seem to realize that. Eggs do not form afterwards. Okay? There's no division of those cells and all of that. They are sitting around in your ovaries. Okay? Some of them almost became full-fledged eggs, but they don't really become that. It just gets interrupted. The process of development gets interrupted a few weeks before the time at which the fetus can be viably sent out in an unassisted fashion. I'm not talking about cesareans or any other stuff. It could now normally come out and be alive. Before that, the last stage of the development stops, and it only starts after puberty, in which case every month, one, possibly two of them emerge, right? Okay. That's controlled by the hormonal system. And even the ones that emerge, in a very physical sense, don't actually become potent eggs before further manipulation, which mostly and easily happens if there's sperm and semen around in the fallopian tubes. Everybody with me? Stop me if everything appears anything appears either unclear or manifestly incorrect. And so in effect, the first thing you're learning that if somebody has to extract eggs from you, right, for in vitro fertilization or any kind of fertilization and all of that, those eggs will have to be treated before they can actually be fertilized. What actually gets taken out from you when it's not normally coming out the fallopian tube, in the process of which it might encounter sperm, is not actually a potent egg. All right? That's the egg situation. In the case of males, life's rather different. Okay. Eggs, of course, are formed not through normal cell division, where one cell divides into two in a process called mitosis, where both the daughter cells, right, next generation cells, have exactly the same complement of chromosomes as the original cells. Instead, the process of mitosis gets stopped at one point, and then a second division happens, and you end up with four cells. This double mitosis process is called meiosis. You should know all of this. It's both in the book, and I assume it's common knowledge. The important thing here is not all of those four cells are viable. One of them is the big one with the egg on it, and the other three hang on the side and eventually die out. In other words, one embryonic cell gives rise to one egg, okay, during the embryonic development, one proto-egg during embryonic development, and not four, even though the process is a process by meiosis. All right? Turn to males. You are probably producing a million sperm every minute, okay? If you're past puberty, all right? They're in your testes, and they will get out of your body during ejaculation, okay? They begin to form fully only around the time of mature sexual maturity. That's adolescence. That's part of the troublesome period that everybody goes through, males and females, when the mind responds very strongly to deep hormonal stuff that goes on, and those stresses get replicated even more because of the way in which our social situation is organized. Some tribal cultures, for example, whenever the children are reaching puberty, they take all the males and females and segregate them together in large huts and leave them around to discover their sexuality as well as they can. And that makes puberty a less psychologically troubling experience, but that's not how any modern society, for good or bad, is organized. Everybody with me? All right. Now, the point at which I'm going to stop over here is going to be the following. So the egg is going to leave the ovary. It's heading through towards the uterus. It's in the fallopian tubes, right? Fertilization, if it happens at all, will happen at that stage when sperm enter the fallopian tube. Okay, sperm move around the egg. The sperm's membrane and the egg's membrane fuse very easily, so a lot of them hang around over there. Okay, just sort of attached, and it's probably purely by chance that one particular one of those attachment areas completely detaches, and so the all that the sperm carries is some chromosomes. The chromosomes enter into the eggs, which besides the female's chromosomes contain tons and tons of stuff, all kinds of proteins, and in particular all the mitochondria, which are the organelles inside the cells that are used to generate energy. And so all the mitochondria came from your mother, and so you can actually trace mitochondria back generation by generation by generation entirely in the female line. Everybody with me? And that's why the ancestral reconstructed mitochondria is called, very, very metaphorically again, that of the original Eve. Okay? Okay. I sometimes when I read all the descriptions of human sexual biology and history that popular writers write, I don't even know whether I should be annoyed and just be delighted at how stupidly funny it is as to all these metaphors, all these pictures that are brought in, and how odd they are, right? As you probably all should know, that the eventual biological sex of the, I'm using sex and not gender, sex of the fertilized cell, should it eventually become, okay, this one started again, should it eventually become an embryo or a fetus, depends on what it inherits, X and X, or X and Y. The X chromosome comes from the mother, but the father can contribute a Y or an X. If the father contributes an X, then the thing is going to be the fetus is going to be female. If the father contributes a Y, then the fetus is going to be a male. All right. Already destroys one mythology that many societies have had in their history. In many countries, from Egypt through the Middle East, through India, I'm not so sure about China, it was very, very commonplace for rulers who wanted male rulers, who wanted male offspring, and whenever the female did not produce male offspring, they either took on another wife or divorced the one they had now and replaced it, because it was a problem of the female that she did not bear sons. Blissfully unaware that the Y chromosome has to come from the male and the female can do absolutely nothing about it except get fertilized by a different male. Okay, that's the only way in which those females might have been able to produce sons, but that's not right. History has made ample use of bad biology right from the beginning all the way down to the scientific racism of the 1970s and 80s. Yeah, everybody with me? Okay. Of course, this might really be a bit simplistic. There is one thing. There's some evidence that does indicate that females can have a role in influencing the sex of offspring. And that is, the physiology of the female controls the pH, okay, the acidity of the liquid in the uterus and the fallopian tubes, and higher acidity is supposed to end up killing more of the sperm that have Y chromosomes than X. Everybody with me? If that's true, if the acidity is higher, then the female is more likely, it's not completely random, the female is more likely to end up with XX embryos. Everybody with me? Fertilized cells. Because it's likely that the 100 or so sperm that are surrounding a particular egg cell, at least a significant number of them are going, unless the male is suffering from some particular condition, at least a significant number of them are going to be sperm that have Y chromosomes. Everybody with me? Okay. This actually has led to some prediction, but I do not know of any data that would let you test these. But that's completely false. I know of tons of data that would let you test this prediction, but I know of no analysis that systematically has done this properly. Is that there is evidence, and this is the part that has to be established fully, that as females get older, the uterine environment gets more acidic. If that is true, then what should one should find that the percentage of female fetuses should be higher with older women than with younger. Testable claim being made in class, you could easily take it up as a paper topic and look for data sets using which you can test these. They are there and they're in the web. Everybody with me? Okay, that's what that would mean. I don't know this simple-minded question. Every now and then I manage to ask simple-minded questions when I'm going through all this reading to which the empirical answer should be straightforward, if a bit laborious to find, but we don't know that. So there might be that level at which the female can control the sex of the fetus. All right. Now, We've gotten to the point where fertilization has taken place. Next thing that has to happen is the fertilized cell has to move on and get from the fallopian tube into the uterus, and then it has to implant in the uterus. Tons and tons of times, okay, it doesn't happen. It just dies off. It doesn't attach within the time frame during which it remains functional, and it just gets removed from the body during the next period. Along with blood, you wouldn't even recognize it, okay, and all of that. Nobody has precise estimates, but it's believed that at least 95%, possibly 99% of fertilizations end up in being removed in that way. All right? First, if then remark, if you really believe that human features, a life that should be called human, begins at fertilization, if you believe that, right? Okay? Then you should wonder where in every one of these cases, the woman is guilty of accidental death. Right? Some sort of accidental death of a human being because the fertilized cell did not implant on the uterus. You want to take bio? Look, there has been a move in the abortion debate on both sides, okay, the pro-choice and the pro-life, to appeal more and more to science, to hide under the veneer of science. So people like Scott, Clara, myself, have a lot of fun saying, oh, you believe that, huh? If you believe that, then these and these are the consequences of what science is telling you. Here's the first one. If you believe fertilization is the beginning of human life, accidental killing of human life happens almost every time people have sex at a time when the female has an egg. Everybody with me? All right. Let's stop at this stage as far as that goes and go and worry a bit about barriers to fertilization and what might not happen, okay? Now, there are lots and lots of people, and Clara discusses her own example, and this was something that was, when they were writing the book, was something that was quite seriously debated as to whether or not she should be putting in her personal example in the book like that. Even though I'd worked a lot with Scott, I suggested, the book partly got written because people like me suggested that they update an earlier book that they had, which is written more like a textbook, and I'm glad they didn't listen to me and wrote this, which is much, much more readable. I hope you're finding that so. I personally was against her putting in personal stuff like that. She absolutely insisted on it and put in the story of her personal struggles of never successfully, okay, becoming pregnant with all these assisted reproductive technologies, right, and all of that. And the difference here is the difference between somebody who's primarily a scientist and philosopher, and somebody, while being a scientist, is primarily a counselor. Being able to talk about her own experience apparently helped her a lot when dealing with clients that she had who were talking about their own problems, and she thought the same thing would happen to people who read the book. It's for others to decide whether that's true or false, but she discusses her own case, and as the book goes on, you'll find that there are... What on earth? All right. As the book goes on, you'll find three other examples of couples that she'll discuss themselves. All of these are real case notes. They're not making up examples of what in this case, and that was important to keep that level of integrity there, because creating completely unreal examples to talk about human things like this, I think, is a bad move, because we might not know lots and lots of things where we are talking about this behavior happened, that those behaviors actually can't happen for humans because we're not quite as free in our behavior as we think, right? I mean, you might go on and talk about somebody who refuses to try an infertility treatment more than once. Very rare. Somebody who gets trapped in that will try it for a while because they know that it's not likely to succeed. All right, so we'll get to some of that examples now, and then I'll pick up on the, well, probably not today. And then Scott will talk about whatever he wants to talk about. He knows where we are in the syllabus on Thursday, and then I'll fill in whatever else needs to of the first eight chapters next Tuesday. But Clara, so the first issue comes up is that there are lots of couples who, for whatever reason, want to have children, right? And want to have children of their own in the sense that they're genetically related to. Now, already we are in territory where we can ask questions, okay? For example, for a long time before I had my own children, I and my wife kept on wondering whether we should have our own biological children or whether we should just adopt, okay? There are plenty of children around in the world, right? We're not exactly underpopulated as a global population. So why want your own biological children? And you know, everybody talks about the other end of it. One straightforward answer also is that it's not that easy to adopt. It's a very expensive process and a very constrained process, probably with the child's interest in mind, to make sure that the adopted parents actually are responsible and do what they are and all of it, compared to which, in a certain social and economic setting, it's a lot easier to have your own children. This was back when we had those discussions, this was a surprising conclusion, sociological conclusion to draw. And in fact, I think, as far as having children and policy towards it goes, that has to be addressed, okay, at some point. The other one, of course, is that there is a way out from that to make the adoption process more simpler, but that requires a very strong commitment to individual religions, okay? Religious organizations can make adoption a lot easier for you, but if you're just secular or you do not want, even if you're religious, but do not want that kind of organized commitment to a particular religious structure, right, then things become a lot more difficult. Everybody with me? Okay, and that's the situation in the United States. Clara told me that's not the situation at all. In Portugal, where adoption is a far, far more straightforward process, and certainly there's no financial cost to it because the welfare state bears it. Everybody with me? Issues that we made right from the beginning. Now, why do people want their own genetic children? It's not a very easy question to answer. And it's also an issue that is certainly a very, very prevalent point of view now in our society, right? That people would. And I don't know of very many people who, like us, went through this reasoning wondering, the world is already overpopulated. Why create new rather than already just adopt, right? Children who are already born and who you could afford to raise much, much better than how they would otherwise raise. That question, strangely enough, is not asked as often as I would think that it would be asked. But there were much, much, much more accepting attitudes towards adoption at other periods in history, right? Okay. We are, in a certain sense, in a different situation. Why? Maybe it's because we now understand heredity and genetics better. But I'm not saying I have the answer to the why, okay, and all of that, and all of it. Clara just simply tells you to wake up from this and accept that you shouldn't want that. I'm not willing to go that far when there's a deeply held belief that people have, right, about it. We need to understand better where it's coming from than simply say, get rid of it, right? I was telling her, saying that is sort of like just coming and telling people, looking around and say, well, just get rid of your religion. No, it's not that easy to go and tell people to get rid of their religion. I mean, it's just, and I'm not even sure why I want to tell them that. But yeah, so I don't think her solution there quite helps. But there is this, right? Why? Do we feel some greater genetic affinity to a child? I find it hard to believe that your feelings would be that different if you've brought up a child from a few weeks old or a month old, and the child has had the same set of experiences, share the same set of experiences with you. Certainly, there is very little evidence to suggest that babies do not bond very well with adoptive parents that take care of them. Okay, everybody with me? Okay, all right. And so it's not clear that whether or not there's any deep psychological fact about us that explains this preference. They may not be, but this preference certainly is out there, right? Everybody with me? Okay. The next thing that people almost never seem to realize or accept, and this is because of a tremendous sexist bias in society, is statistics show that in infertile couples, at least in the United States, the male is more often the infertile one than the female. Okay. They don't make this point, but I am going to make it, just as they don't make the point about pH, I'm going to make it, is that there are tons and tons of ways of generating male infertility. Okay. Myth, you can walk in front of a radiation tube and you're going to become infertile. That actually does not happen. Okay, contrary to common belief. On the other hand, at age 18, you probably have the highest frequency of functional sperm if you're a male in this country in the last 30 or 40 years. Okay, the ratio of fertile to infertile or functional to non-functional sperm increases after that, right? But it obviously does not increase at the same rate in everybody, and nobody knows the exact upper limit at which fertile sperm functional sperm is no longer produced. Just as we now know examples of women being able to be fertilized at in the upper 50s, we know of males who can produce functional sperm all the way into their 90s. Everybody with me? Okay. Now, on the other hand, if the ratio of fertile to infertile sperm is quite low in the semen, then there are so many infertile sperm that fertilization by a fertile sperm becomes very unlikely in the fallopian tube. All right? Sperm often have an incorrect number of chromosomes. Tons and tons of sperm can end up generating trisomies when the sperm fertilizes the egg to produce a fertilized cell. A lot of these will not implant in the uterus, but there's also a large number that will, and then there'll be a miscarriage after 6 weeks or so, or 8 weeks. Everybody with me? And miscarriages also have deep psychological consequences.